Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 18, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
Now, this week on the show, it's a bit of a Sega special, I think you could say, this week.
Sega.
Because we have got the man himself.
Yes.
The guy that pretty much ran the whole thing in its heyday.
Yeah, well, made it successful as well. You know, he was the guy that led the campaign against Nintendo.
Tom Kalinske.
Tom Kalinske, yeah. And the introduction of Sonic and, you know, all these great titles that really defined an era.
Well, it was, you know, it was really Sega's most successful era, and Tom was the CEO all the way through that era.
Yep.
And also, I mean, we did a little bit more background research on Tom. He's a guy that came up with He-Man.
Barbie as well.
Yeah, which I know you're very pleased about, to ask him some Barbie questions. Yeah. So, Tom Kalinske on the Retro Hour in the next 35 minutes or so. Get the inside story on Sega in their heyday. And also, it'd be quite interesting to find out what he thinks of them today as well, I think, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. And there's also a new movie coming up.
There is, yeah. So we've timed this very well. Seth Rogen, I think, is behind it. Is
that right? Yeah, he's directing it, so... So, this is going to be big news, guys.
Plenty of Sega on this week's show, and if we are sounding a little bit croaky at the moment, I must apologise. We have just gone back from a rather large weekend.
Yeah, it was in Blackpool. We went to Play Blackpool.
Yeah, Play Expo. What did you think then?
I thought it was really good. I kind of enjoyed meeting up with other people more than the actual show itself. There was some good stuff. We went on this virtuality, which was the first virtual reality.
From 1991 or something, wasn't
it? Yeah, and it took me about 2 hours for my neck to recover because it was so heavy.
Well, these things, we did see it. Was it last year in Wolverhampton? We saw it, but it wasn't working then, was it?
Yeah, it's £1 a play this time.
Yeah, it was like £2 back in the day, so that was a bargain. But these things are actually based on like Amiga 3000 custom boards, aren't they?
Yeah, I think you have an Amiga 3000 strapped to your back, basically.
My back is still feeling like it now, actually, yeah. But we played this game. I've been trying to find the name of it now, but I can't. It's supposed to do with... Something Raptor?
Yeah, they had it on Games Master once when they did early virtual reality stuff.
And these guys, I think it was developed in Leicester, wasn't it? So not far away from us. But it's basically like a first-person shooter where it's like quick on the draw, really got to shoot
about
each other,
six frames per second. Yeah. But yeah, it's amazing still. Like
I kept getting picked up by this like Raptor thing and then dropped down and then Ravi would shoot me in the head and then I just looked down and see my arms explode in front of my body.
So, yeah, it's very strange as well because they had no sound. So you just had some guy from the museum shouting stuff at you like, move left, go
you're
up.
You're dead. So yeah, that was loads of fun. And we tried Sociable Soccer.
Really good. Really good gameplay. I've never scored a goal in Sensible Soccer, but Sociable, yeah.
Hey, you whooped me on it, didn't you?
Yeah. And I think they had a rude motto at the beginning towards FIFA, which
oh,
was
they did,
good.
yes, which we won't repeat on a family-friendly podcast. But for those who might not be familiar with that, this is John Hare from Sensible. He's behind it. It's basically the spiritual successor to Sensible Soccer.
Yeah.
And by the looks of that, I mean, it was pretty much, you know, that looked like a finished product to me.
Yeah, and we didn't get to see any of the guest talks, but... He spoke down there.
Yeah,
and,
on Sunday.
Also Jim Bagley, who we'd had on a couple of weeks ago. So we actually bumped into Jim in real life, which was great.
Yeah, and on the night we were out with the guys from RGDS and Tenpence Arcade, they were there as well. Baz, who we've got to give a shout to, a loyal Amiga fan.
Yeah, it was great. We went out to Blackpool. We ended up in a karaoke bar. Yeah, you may have seen a post where we're on about RGDS defecting to us. We're trying to cause a little bit of controversy. So.
Yeah, sorry, Aaron.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah, loads of fun, though, and I think I can still taste Jaeger bombs now.
Oh, God.
Not the best, but yeah, when's the next one on? Is it Manchester, isn't it? End of the summer, I think?
Yeah,
October.
Yeah.
So
we'll probably be there.
We will, no doubt. So what an amazing weekend, though. So if you did come and say hello, we did meet a few podcast listeners at... Blackpool over the weekend. Thanks
really
for coming
nice.
On, guys.
And there was that nice little display as well from the Retro Computer Museum that had the Commodore 16 and a few Amiga things that got us interested.
Yeah, I think we're there like most of the afternoon, weren't we?
Yeah. I must say, we found out something when we came back which was quite disappointing, which is SoundCloud's RSS feed. It's basically been dead for 2 days.
Yeah, so we were away for the weekend. We released an episode on Friday night before we went away. And then while we're away, we're just getting all these like messages started coming up on my phone going, you know, is there something wrong with your episode, lads? Are your servers down? And we're like trying to access it remotely. My laptop died over the weekend as well when we're in Blackpool.
All running out of power on our phones as well.
So we're a bit concerned. And then unfortunately, it turns out, SoundCloud's RSS feed, SoundCloud, the company that we pay to host our podcast.
And lots of other podcasts do worldwide as well. So they're all out.
Yeah, so if you try to get us on pretty much any of the podcast clients that don't do a local like cash copy of it, chances are you maybe didn't get last week's show. So and it was a good one as well. I mean,
it was, and it's available on YouTube, guys, as well. And it should be, hopefully, by the time this show's out,
Yeah, well, fingers
unless
crossed.
Unless SoundCloud goes bust, it should be...
I think we'll have moved if it's not by this weekend. But so if you didn't listen to last week's show, maybe you had a problem downloading it. I'd say give it a download because it was one of our best episodes, wasn't it?
Oh, it was amazing. Really good. And Ben actually joined us for the news.
Yeah.
So we had like an extra guest and then we got in depth with him. It was great.
Yeah, one for the C64 heads last week. So
definitely.
If you didn't manage to get it because of technical problems, give it another go. You should get it. Yeah. You know, you can listen on the website, theretrohour.com. Right then, before Tom Kalinske, let's get into this week's stories. This is quite interesting. Retro arcade VR.
Yeah, and it's even got the awful looking carpet to match it. And, you know, cigarette butts everywhere.
So this is essentially, you go into a virtual arcade environment. This is on the HTC Vive. So it's a VR, you put the VR headset on, obviously, and you're transported back to the 80s into like a seaside arcade.
Yeah, totally. And you can add new arcade stuff that, you know, they have Game Boys there that you could pick up. They've got Joust and all the old classic stuff, you know, like you'll have a Frogger machine and Arknoid and everything. And you just go up and play on it.
Yeah. So you're walking around the arcade and you actually walk up to these like cabinets.
Yeah. So you could have your custom cabs of your arcade. Maybe in the future you could probably invite your friends and do... two-player, that might be interesting.
Stand behind your friend and shout obscenities into the rear.
Yeah, so it's kind of bringing that co-op player experience back in the virtual world.
You know what it needs, though? You need kind of like smell-o-vision, so you know the smell of like cigarettes and
stuff. Oh, you don't. You don't want to see the arcade, especially at play this weekend.
Yeah, we ended up in one in Blackpool, didn't we? Afterwards, that was kind of fun. But you didn't. We won some random prizes at the arcade in Blackpool over the weekend, like a Pac-Man stress reliever.
Yeah, I got an astronomy solar system kit.
Have you built your kit yet?
No.
But it was actually cool. I mean, I'll tell you the funniest thing, though, when we're in that arcade over the weekend. I probably haven't been to an arcade like that since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Don't go to the seaside much anymore. And I was walking through, and there's a bit where all the fruit machines are and all that, and there's a little sign there going, you must be over 18 to enter this adults area. And I was like, oh, I'm not allowed in there. I was like, actually, yeah, I am. I'm in my 30s. They need those signs in this game to be authentic.
I find it is a bit weird, though, the arcade, because it was all on this kind of ticket system and winning prizes and stuff. And in the corner, there was a few broken old House of the Dead 2 machines and
which
stuff.
Which you found straight away, though, didn't you?
Which we went straight on, yeah.
Made a beeline for that. So, but yeah, this is kind of cool that you can recreate the arcade experience in your house. And I mean, if you've got something like an Oculus Rift and that as well, it's...
Yeah, machines that maybe, you know, hard to get hold of.
Saves you building your own MAME cabinet, doesn't it?
Oh, God, they're heavy, yeah.
Easier to move. Now, obviously, we have got quite a bit of Sega news this week as well, since Tom Kalinske is going to be on. And this is quite well-timed. Sega 3D Classics Collection has just been released for the Nintendo 3DS.
Okay, so yes, we can obviously see the Sega Nintendo wars over here.
Oh yeah, long gone.
Yeah, they're cross-releasing, but this looks good, man.
Yeah, well it is, it's a collection. I mean, they've got, you know, some of Sega's most famous games on here, stuff like Power Drift, the original Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, Altered Beast.
Well, it's quite interesting though, actually, some people were saying, you know, why have you put the Mega Drive version of Altered Beast on, not the arcade version? But what they've done with these games is, you know, obviously the 3DS can give you a 3D effect without glasses or anything like that. But they said the original Alter BC arcade version didn't have parallax scrolling, so they couldn't make it into 3D.
Nice.
So that's why they had to put the Mega Drive one on.
Well, it says here as well that they've got custom themes. Mm-hmm. So you can have, like, even going back to the SG-1000 early Sega machines, then you can go to the Saturn and Dreamcast and Game Gear, so...
Well, one thing that you'll quite like, because I know you've tried this system before, there is a couple of Master System 3D games that they've ported to it.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Fantasy Zone 2 and Maze Walker. Now, you actually tried the original Sega Master System 3D glasses, didn't you?
Oh, God, they were awful. Absolutely awful. If you want a seizure.
Yeah, it was like running about, what, like 6 frames a second, wasn't it? Flickery screen, but... if you want a slightly less headache-inducing way of playing those, they're on this collection.
Well, that's cool, because it's a 3DS. Mm-hmm. So if you've got these 3D games, then you're going to get that 3D angle.
Yeah, exactly. So cool. Quite a nice little bonus feature. And that's just got released about a week ago, so it's out now. And I never thought I'd see the day when we saw an example of a high-definition VHS tape.
Yeah, this is crazy. Now, I remember when I was a little kid, these... books in science, and they'd all be about how televisions worked and CRTs. Mm. And they had this thing in Japan which was called HDTV, and it had like loads of lines on it and scan lines, and everyone's like, oh my God, this is amazing. But that was years ago and we never got anything. They found this old VHS that was a kind of demo example of a HD VHS.
And this is in 1993.
93, yeah.
Yeah, so what's cool about it is, I mean, you look at this video, and a few of the news websites have been running this as well. And then what this essentially was, HDVHS, was, like you said, it was a prototype for, you know, these new kind of high-definition displays they were working on at the time. Obviously, it never got released because DVD and all that came along, you know, by then they're already working on the DVD format.
Yeah.
But you look at this now, and I know we've got cell phone cameras or mobile phone cameras that look better than this, but it does look really clear. There's no, like, you know, wow and flutter like you used to get on, like, VHS tapes and all that. And really, it looks like it could have been filmed today if it weren't for, like, you know, the dodgy kind of early 90s.
Yeah, if it wasn't for the fashion sense.
There's some proper shocking hairdos in this video, isn't there?
Yeah.
What's really cool as well, though, I mean, you look around it and they show you, like, Times Square.
Oh, yeah, and they're going to New York as well with all the old graffiti and stuff, yeah. And Brooklyn and...
Well, even, like, the theatre is showing Paper Moon. That was out, you know, in 1993. And there's even Camel cigarettes, a massive billboard for those, and obviously you can't advertise cigarettes and billboards in America anymore. And the creepiest bit, though, is this guy that's walking under the World Trade Center, and you see that in high definition. And,
oh, yeah, wow.
And that was the same year it got bombed originally, wasn't it, 1993? So that must have been just before this recording. But it's just cool getting a glimpse into, you know, that era and seeing it in, you know, kind of like modern films look like in a way. It's a bit weird.
Well, that's it. You know, it was the year that Jurassic Park was out. Yeah. And I remember the VHS quality of that. My friend had it. And
Yours probably wasn't an original, right?
No.
No, dodgy you are.
No, it wasn't original, but we'd watched it so many times and lent it to so many mates that... that kind of footage was stretched out.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, they didn't survive a lot of plays,
no,
did they?
But if they'd released Jurassic Park with this, Jesus.
Now, Nolan Bushnell is back on it, as your headline says here. So he's back into games.
Yeah, and he recently said, mobile phone games are lacking the fundamental kind of principles of arcade games and the fun, because they're doing these, you know, models of like pay to win or like... kind of, oh, you earn a few things and then if you spend some money, you can get a bit further, or you have to wait 2 days. You know, it's not really the arcade experience.
Or spam all your mates on Facebook and we'll unlock another level. That's quite common,
so,
isn't it?
So he says he's come up with 30 concepts over the past decade and a half, and 8 of those he'll be turning into mobile apps.
Mm-hmm. They're going to be released as early as next year.
Yeah, 2017, So.
Now, it's a company called Spill Gaming, Spill Games he's working with. So they're essentially just asking him to come up with ideas for games that he thinks will work well on modern platforms.
Yeah, I guess just using him like a guru.
If anyone knows games, it's Nolan Bushnell, isn't it? Come
exactly.
on.
Exactly. And it's not going to be Atari, is it, these days?
Oh, exactly, yeah. They're just, suing people, aren't they, at the moment, as we heard last week? Now, we have got quite a bit of Sega news this week to talk about, and there are a couple of new movies coming out based around Sega, one of which we'll talk about in a moment, but this is actually based around a Sega franchise, this one. They're turning Shinobi into a film.
I think they're kind of pushing these... 16-bit consoles now and trying to get the legacy out there because everyone seems to have forgot.
Well, this was, apparently it's a spin-off of one of Sega's companies called Stories International, and the idea was, a couple of years ago, they said, right, you know, these old franchises we've got, why don't we try and turn these into, like, proper blockbuster movies, pretty much, and they banded around a few names by the looks of it here. So, under consideration was Streets of Rage.
Oh, that would have been good.
Crazy Taxi. Oh, can you imagine a movie about Crazy Taxi?
It'd just be the Offspring theme tune constantly going.
Something I can't see how you'd make a full film of. Virtua Fighter, how are you going to make like a 90-minute movie? Well, they managed it with Mortal Kombat.
I could probably actually see Queen Latifah in Crazy Taxi.
Yeah.
With Steve Martin. Like, no, in the back.
Altered Beast, Golden Axe was under consideration too. You get a nice fancy film out of Golden Axe, I think, though.
Yeah, Arnie would be good in Golden Axe.
What, as the warrior?
Yeah.
Like Warwick Davis is like the...
The little guys with sacks?
But Shinobi is the first one that they're planning on making into a movie. Now, I think, you know, I used to love Shinobi in the arcades when I was a kid. And I don't think there's enough ninja movies around anymore. You don't really see a lot of them now, do you?
Yeah, you really don't. There was a ninja period in the 90s, wasn't there?
Yeah, like, remember Three Little Ninjas? That was an awesome film.
Well, Surf Ninjas as well.
It was everything ninja for a while, wasn't it? And I think over here in England as well.
Beverly Hills Ninja.
Over here in England, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was called Hero Turtles, because ninjas were considered too risque, I think, for kids at the time. But I think it's pretty cool that, you know, they might make a movie out of Shinobi. I mean, let's be honest, there's kind of not a good track record of video games getting turned into movies and coming out any good.
No, but... especially, they've done the big names, haven't they?
And, your Tomb Raiders have been done. And
There was rumours of a Sonic one coming up, but yeah, you're totally right, like Mario Brothers and Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat. Yeah, there's a big list.
Normally all crap.
Yeah, Doom.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, this is kind of cool. It's a bit of novelty that you might, you know, you're going to get a movie about Shinobi. We'll all see it. Who used to play Shinobi in the old days? It'd be nice if the focus reference on like a proper updated game, though.
Yeah, make the movie and then release a new
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll pop your link in the show notes at theretrohour.com if you want to find out more. Now, we mentioned the Xbox 360 last week because it was the end of an era. Microsoft announced that it was being discontinued after a decade on sale.
Yeah.
And they've been releasing a few kind of statistics about the 360 over the last week or so. And there's quite an interesting article here with Robbie Back, who's a former head of Xbox, and he revealed quite an interesting fact about how expensive this Red Ring of Death
Yeah, because he was a decision maker, wasn't he? So he'd be the guy that, shall we do this? And mm-hmm. then he'll be the guy that can control the money or know which departments are going to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent £1 billion on fixing the Red Ring of Death.
So one mistake, this lack of cooling, which is essentially what ruined all these machines, isn't it?
Yeah.
It says here, one mistake cost $1 billion.
And it was still worth it because the amount of consoles they still sold. You know, I think if they hadn't have got on that Red Ring of Death thing
mm-hmm.
and recalled machines and changed them, I think the Xbox 360's legacy would not be as mm-hmm. strong as it is now.
Well, absolutely. And it says here, you know, because I remember, I mean, we've both had 360s that have had the Red Ring of Death before. Yeah. I'm on about my fourth one now. But actually, the one I've got now has lasted me since about 2009.
So what was that trick that everyone used to do, reballing it, where they basically take the processor off, put it in an oven,
mm-hmm.
so all the solder melted, and then put it back on.
There's an even more ghetto solution, wrapping it up in a towel.
Oh, yeah, and then overheating it
yeah, intentionally doing it. It'd work again for like a day or something. But I do remember, though, because mine broke. I think it was just after, like, you know, the warranty had expired on it. Because I didn't get my new, mine was a used one actually, but it was, I think it had like 6 months warranty left on it and it broke then. But I remember Microsoft, I rang them up, you know, because I'd read online that apparently they will still repair them even though you're out of warranty because it's like a design defect. And I think they extended it to 3 years in the end.
You know,
they fixed it 3 years after the warranty ran out. So that's a bit that cost them the £1 billion, a promise to repair it because, you know, they admitted, all right, it's our fault, we screwed up. But, I mean, like you said then, I think if they didn't, they'd have got such a bad reputation, wouldn't they?
Yeah, because every machine, you know, you only had a certain range that were the Red Ring of Death ones.
The originals, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, it cost them a lot of money. But like you said, I mean, it left them with, I think customers appreciated it after that. They kind of said, all right, Microsoft screwed up. But, you know, they put their hands up and, like, we're going to make it right now. And
yeah.
So it was a good thing
and
to do.
And it was the best thing for them to do, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, they kind of to and fro'd in that generation though, didn't they? I think eventually the PS3, I think, was a more popular one, but it took them a long time to overtake them.
Yeah.
It was only the last couple of years. I can't believe this next story as well. Now, Jerry Ellsworth, who is...
I love her.
Oh, don't we all love Jerry now?
If anybody, even my girlfriend knows this, if I could ever run away with someone, it would be Jerry, because she'd be able to build a C-64.
If you're stranded on a desert island, she's the person you'd want to be stuck with, yeah. She'd build you like a SID chip out of a coconut or something. So, but Jerry, I mean, for those that are not familiar with the Commodore scene, she is, you know, she made the Commodore 64 in a joystick.
Yeah, which sold on QVC, so one of the biggest kind of commercial things. And now she's working with Steam
mm-hmm.
doing AR casts.
Yeah.
I think, which is this kind of augmented reality tabletop mm-hmm. gaming thing.
We had Bill Hurd on the other week. She's worked with Bill before as well. And she's a very, very talented engineer.
Yeah, she does a series called Tech Girl and Fat Bloke.
I haven't seen
that. The Fat Man and Tech Girl, yeah, that's it.
What, does it just show you how to make stuff?
Circuit Girl and the Fat Man, yeah. And they broadcast live, and it's basically, they'll have like little projects and they'll both discuss it and kind of build them on air and stuff.
Yeah.
It's quite cool.
Well, she's, you know, she's, especially in the Commodore 64 scene, I mean, very well respected and, you know, really talented as well. But it's someone has nicked her Commodore 64 guitar.
This is, she made a C64 guitar that looks like it actually works.
It does, apparently, yeah. Well, there's actually a video of her on YouTube playing, like, you know, Sid stuff on it.
So like, oh, God. And this actually has, like, you know, the head of the guitar and everything built in, and the bass bit is the C64.
Yeah, so you got the guitar neck, and then the air goes into a C64. You play the Sid chip with the guitar, by the looks of it.
But like, who's going to have that? They can't pull it out in a few years if they're a C64 collector, or they can't sell it on eBay or anything, because it's so unique. There's only one
in
the world.
It's one of a kind, yeah, exactly. So apparently she was at a party and she brought it along to play some music, you know, gone for a couple of drinks, mingling and all that, come back and someone had walked off with it. But
well, there's going to be photos of them emerging online at some other party, like, check out my guitar. And
you
then,
know what I mean?
Yeah, geeks will track it down, hopefully.
Yeah, you mess with the wrong person there, Mr. Thief, whoever you are. So keep an eye out for a Commodore 64 guitar appearing in any local pawn shops and stuff.
Yeah.
If you see it, we'll pass the news on to Jerry. Let's get it back for her.
Yeah.
Now, this, you know, how many Spectrum reboots do you need? Let's be honest. Although There is a new one on the way. This is called the next Sinclair Spectrum.
Okay, the next. What's the difference between this one and the other?
Well, this one, it is a recreation of the Sinclair Spectrum, but in FPGA.
Ah, okay. So,
so it's like a modern take on the Spectrum Plus. It looks like Spectrum Plus design if you look at it. I know there's been a few of these going on recently, but this one is actually, they've got a license from Sky, who quite interestingly own the Trope, because they bought Amstrad, didn't they, who bought Sinclair.
Oh, that makes so much sense, actually, yeah. So Sky Television bought Amstrad to use the technology for the set-top boxes, but with Amstrad, they got a bonus of Sinclair packages.
Yeah, exactly. So I think maybe they've just realised this recently, so now they've officially licensed it. Sky In-Home Service Limited have given them the permission to manufacture these.
Maybe if they start seeing some money coming through this or something, they may do some Sky Television Spectrum channels where you could play the old specky games
on
it.
On your
set-top
box.
Yeah.
Well, this is really cool. I mean, it's, you know, like a lot of these kind of recent ones have, it's got, you know, stuff like RGB, mini HDMI on there as well. It uses an SD card instead of, you know, loading off tapes, and it's got, like, you know, DB9 compatible joystick interface on there. You can use a PS2 mouse, and it's really, you know, it's for the Spectrum fans again. You can even get a white one though, which is really cool.
What a period to be a Spectrum fan,
isn't
it? Yeah, it must be going mad.
Exactly, it's like, you know, you're not short of options if you need a new machine, are you?
No.
Let's be honest. Now, you spotted this story yesterday, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, I thought it might have been a screenshot or a small video or something.
So this is essentially, a guy has managed to get Windows 95 running on an Apple Watch. Now, you showed me this, and we're in the hotel in Blackpool, weren't we? I had a slightly sore head, I think, and we're about to go for breakfast. I looked at it, I was like, oh, it's fake, someone's just running a video. but it turns out it's not. So what this guy's done, it's a chap called Nick Lee, and he posted this video on YouTube.
Yeah.
And apparently he's kind of used some of the development tools for the Apple Watch, swapped out a few of the components, and actually put like an x86 emulator in there as well, and kind of run it virtually.
Because it's ARM-based, isn't it?
Yeah, the Apple Watch is ARM, but Windows 95 only runs on Intel. So he's actually managed to get it boot up. And, you know, you look at the specs of the Apple Watch here, it runs a 520 megahertz CPU, it's got half a gig of RAM, 8 gigabytes of storage. And you think, you know, that would have been like a supercomputer back when Windows 95 came out, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could run Duke Nukem really well on that.
Well, I mean, he's showing you here. I mean, you can actually use a touchscreen on the Apple Watch to open the start menu and all that. Obviously, being like, you know, a 48mm screen, it's not going to be like, you're going to have the best user experience using it.
No, yeah.
And apparently it takes an hour to boot.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's doing quite a lot of stuff under the hood. But it's, I think, you know, Apple products are generally known for being quite locked down, aren't they? And you can't...
Yeah, that's the whole thing about Apple, isn't it? The closed environment. And
the walled garden.
Yeah, and Windows is the big open environment, but that leads to malware.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But I think, you know, there are ways around this if you know how to do it. And this guy proves, you know, nothing's impossible.
Yep.
Now, before we chat to the legendary Tom Kalinske, we're going to ask him about this in a moment as well. But the Console Wars, which was a book, wasn't it? A couple of years ago. Blake Harris did the book, and there was talk about this, and it's going to happen very soon, and they turn this into a proper blockbuster movie.
Now, this is a proper movie. We talk about movies on the Retro Hour.
Yeah, indie stuff a lot of the time.
And a lot of the time they're documentaries, and they're kind of aimed at nerds. But this is Seth Rogen, and this is going to be out there, you know, as like Steve Jobs' movie, or something on that level, you know, because this story hasn't really been told to the new generation of the fierce console wars that happened before the Wii and before all these items.
Well, this is essentially the story of the, you know, the really brutal, bitter battle that happened back in the early 90s and late 80s. Nintendo versus Sega, isn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of people hold fond memories of that era, but they're not necessarily interested enough anymore to kind of look into exactly what happened and the people behind it and all that kind of thing. So it'd be nice to get the story out there as well. I know that Tom Kalinske, who we're going to talk to in a moment, was quite, you know, involved with the book when it came out. He actually spoke to Blake and, you know, shared a lot of his stories. And he said when he read the book, he actually didn't realise quite a lot of it from Nintendo's side.
Ah, so that's good. And for me, these guys defined cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was it, you know, it was a cool-off, wasn't it? Who was the coolest?
Yeah.
And by doing that, they just changed the whole gaming scene into this kind of adult-y PlayStation, cool, edgy place.
Well, I'm just looking forward to seeing, like, the recreations of the, you know, the sets of probably, like,
Sega HQ and
Sega HQ, and, like, you know, the old systems will be there, and they'll be, like, you know, doing, like, I imagine, scenes of developing the games and all that. So it's going to be cool, isn't it? Just seeing all that stuff. So, very interestingly, Tom Kalinske's thoughts. So we're going to have to ask him next.
Yeah, there'll be a whole surge of interest in Sega and Nintendo again.
Absolutely. Well, we are going to chat to Tom Kalinske now. Now, we'll just say before we played this interview, we did have a few issues with Skype.
It was a bit glitchy for about 5 minutes at the beginning, but then it does pick up.
So do give it a bit of time. We just swap to a headset and we do call him back about two or three times, but
I think it's hard with these transatlantic connections, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's, you know, but a guy like Tom Kalinske, it's worth, you know, maybe putting up with not amazing HD audio quality to hear these stories he's got coming up in the next half an hour. So do bear with it. It does improve after about 5 minutes. For the next half an hour, here he is, former CEO of Sega, Tom Kalinske, on the Retro Hour. And we'll catch you again next Friday.
Sega!
Welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, Tom. It's amazing to have you on. Now, we're going to be talking about video games in a moment, but I think everybody of our generation, I mean, your resume kind of reads like a documentation of my childhood, if you like. So I've got to ask you about He-Man, first of all. How did the character in the TV show of He-Man come around? Because I know you were heavily involved in that, weren't you, when you worked for Mattel?
Oh, yeah. It was kind of interesting. He-Man was one of the most, I think, well-researched developments that we ever did at Mattel. Because you have to understand, we didn't have a male action figure line, and Hasbro had Star Wars and G.I. Joe, and we didn't have much of anything. We had something called Big Jim for a while, but that didn't work out too well. And so I started researching all different themes that would be appealing. We researched everything you could imagine, from policemen to firemen to Marvel characters to DC characters to whatever else was on television at the time. Several things that we just kind of made up, and He-Man was obviously one of those, a heroic NSC figure, very muscular. You know, he looks like me, you can probably tell that. and of course, as part of that concept, an adversary, and that was Skeletor. So it was frankly surprising to most of us, this fantasy character did so well in the research, and then we went ahead and developed the toy line first. The toy line came first. Okay. We developed He-Man and his one Iron Man and his friends, and then and Skeletor and his. Of course, we had the big playset, Castle Grayskull, and other playsets. And the line did very, very well. That first year, we did something like $75 million in sales, which in those years was very, very good. The chairman of the board, a guy named Art Spear, came into my office one day and he said, "Well, yeah, it's nice you developed this toy line for boys, but it'll never amount to much because you don't have a TV show or a movie and you can't get one." And that kind of annoyed me. And I said, "You want to bet?" So I started working with Eddie Smart and got to know Lou Scheimer, who ran Filmation Studios. And they really took this project on. How do we get a television show? It's going to be very expensive, about $7.5 million to do an animated 65 episode so it could run for 13 weeks, 5 days a week after school. The show was so popular, we actually made money off of selling the advertising on the television show. So it was quite a successful endeavor. I think I probably talked enough about that. Now you go on to something else.
I don't remember a household without He-Man figures somewhere.
Yeah, when I was everyone a kid, had them. And to be fair, it was quite a scary show as a kid. But looking back, you know, Skeletor and Castle Grayskull, they were quite, you know, for young kids, it was actually quite cutting edge, really, wasn't it?
Well, it was edgy. But remember at the end, and one of the things that Joe Morrison and John Weems did was they made sure that there was a moral message throughout the show. Of Skeletor and his guys were stealing stuff or something, you know, the moral message at the end might be, now kids, you can see that stealing is bad and you shouldn't do that. You know, so there was always some good message at the end of each episode.
So what was your first computer experience then?
Gosh, nobody's ever asked me that before. We had a children's computer called the TLC, and for the life of me now, I can't remember what. I think it was the learning computer. Clever name.
Yep.
And it was a very rudimentary first effort at doing a computer for young kids. You know, wasn't it in color? It was an LCD screen with a keyboard. You could do very, very little with it, and it cost still $100-something, and it was not successful. So that was my first computer experience with. Of course, we were using big computers in the company for doing lots of processing of things. But it was my first real consumer computer. And then after that, we did the handheld games, which are what would be considered a racing game and an American football game. Only you only had five players on each side. And we marketed those to fathers for Father's Day, and they were very successful. And that was the start of what became Intellivision. Mm. And the Intellivision was developed, obviously, by Mattel to compete with Atari. And for a while, it was successful. And then both Atari and Intellivision obviously took a big nosedive.
So after Mattel, then, how did you get to Sega?
I left Mattel to resurrect a company in your neck of the woods called Matchbox. And a guy named David Yeh, who was a friend of mine, who did a lot of contract manufacturing. He ran a big manufacturing operations out of Hong Kong and Macau, and he was quite successful, and we became friends. So we decided to go after Matchbox. Matchbox was in receivership in the UK, and you know how that works. I mean, you have to get something out of receivership. You not only have to work with the creditors and the banks, but also with the unions. And so we managed to try to revive Matchbox. The deal was we kept a factory open in where they make the Enfield.
Okay, yeah.
The rifles, Enfield. And we had to obviously move a lot of operations to plants in Hong Kong and Macau in order to boss and be competitive to the pricing of Hot Wheels and other brands. So we did that, and we basically restructured. Matchbox was mostly a UK, European, Australian company, more so than it was a U.S. company. And so we had to travel around to Germany and France and Italy and Spain and resurrect the businesses in each market. And so we traveled. He and I traveled. I traveled more than he did, but I traveled about 200 days a year. And we got it done, and we took it public, and we were kind of successful with it, and we were exhausted. And somebody made an offer to buy it. And so right after we had completed those negotiations were reaching where we could see it was completed. I family on a vacation to Hawaii, and the chairman of Sega kind of tracked me down there, and I had known him. It wasn't like he was a stalker or something. I'd known him from business, both when I was at Mattel and at Matchbox. You got to come to Japan with me and see what 16-bit technology is all about. And eventually went, and I was very, very impressed by 16-bit. And you can imagine my experience before that had been television, which you could consider maybe 2-bit technology. So I sort of missed the 8-bit, what it looked like, and I got familiar with it, obviously, what Master System looked like and NES looked like. But 16-bit to me was just eye-opening. I thought it was astonishing at the time. I know that sounds crazy today. It was really different, and I fell in love with it.
Well, obviously, you know, around that time, Nintendo were kind of had a bit of a monopoly on gaming, particularly in the U.S. How did you go about taking them on?
You're absolutely right. I mean, they had, and this is, people told me not to take this position because Nintendo had 98% of the market. And, you know, they controlled all the third-party publishers. If you dared publish on a different system, Nintendo would somehow punish you. If you were a retailer and you dared to bring in a Sega product, or NEC product, you would get shipments of NES cut back and you wouldn't get the quantities that you wanted or thought you could sell through to consumers. So they had tremendous market power. You know, looking at that, my strategy was we got to be very different. We're going to leave them the children's market, the young boys, girls market, and we're going to go after teens and college age students primarily. And we're going to position Nintendo as the little kids platform, knowing full well that if the teenage boy wants to play on Sega and he has a younger brother at home, he's going to want to play on Sega too. So that was all part of the original thinking. And then, of course, the bigger parts were we were going to go after sports games, American football, baseball, FIFA soccer. And most importantly, we were going to, you know, one character that we all loved was Sonic the Hedgehog. We changed it dramatically from what was originally as the Japanese development team had originally presented it, and we were going to lower the price of our hardware, Steam Genesis, Mega Drive in your country from $199 to $149, and be very aggressive in going after Nintendo. Amazingly, all that worked.
It must have been very strange at the time entering the European market as well, because it was so fragmented with consoles and computers,
and obviously computer games were more important in Europe than they were even in the United States. So, you know, it was a different, little bit of a different approach. But I think the thing that I was struck by most is, you know, we were very aggressive in our marketing and advertising in the U.S. In the U.K., I think they were even more aggressive and cleverer in their advertising than we were. I mean, there were some outstanding commercials that were done in the U.K.
I remember as well you had the Sega Scream campaign, which was, you know, kind of, again, that appealed more to that cooler kind of late teens generation, really. How did that come about then, that campaign?
So we had been doing the Sega Does What Nintendo Don't campaign prior. We had a number of agencies pitch our account. Wyden and Kennedy, which had the Nike business, was one of them. Booz Allen Jacobs was a current agency, did another pitch, and several others. Goodby was just this dynamo. I mean, he was so aggressive. He came up with a Sega Scream. I mean, we all jumped up, you know, and took notice at that. And then, of course, the Welcome to the Next Level in text streaming across the screen was very clever to position us as the next level. I've noticed many other companies use that line now, Welcome to the Next Level. And then again, the humor that he brought advertising. I mean, one of my favorite commercials here in the U.S. was where we positioned the Nintendo NES as a slow old smoky milk truck, the Genesis as a Ferrari, you know, and yeah. Just very clever advertising that went along with a lot of the other activities that my marketing team was doing.
I bet you were getting lots of lawsuits from Nintendo at that time.
Oh, we really got under their skin, which of course I enjoyed tremendously. I don't know if you remember the Game Gear commercial. So Game Gear, of course, was handheld, LCD, color screen, as opposed to Game Boy, black and white or green and white screen. So we positioned them as like a, you know, dogs are colorblind. We had a line in there about, well, if you can't tell the difference, you're like a dog that wants to drink out of a toilet. This just drove Nintendo crazy. They immediately sent a cease and desist order, and we ran the commercial a few more times, you know, and then off the air, but it already had its impact on the market.
All right, I actually found a little earbuds and microphone.
Yeah, so that sounds a lot better than it did.
Maybe this will be somewhat of an improvement.
You mentioned the European market then too and how different it was. I mean, one thing that really, you know, we noticed was it was called the Genesis in America and the Mega Drive here in the UK. Did that cause problems with marketing then? And what was kind of the story behind that?
Yeah, of course, it would have been much better had we been able to have the same name around the world for the product. But unfortunately, the name Mega Drive was taken in the United States and was owned by, I can't remember who now. But anyway, they weren't going to let us use it. So we had to come up with a different name for the U.S. And it worked out okay. I mean, Genesis, of course, has a couple different meanings. And, you know, it has a biblical meaning and it has a rebirth kind of meaning. So that worked out, I think, very well for us. But, of course, it would have been better had we been able to have one name around the world.
Well, it was very interesting in the UK as well, because we kind of got everything a bit later on with Sega. A lot of the places adopted 8-bit machines like America, and we were very like slow with the Master System and stuff. Was it kind of strange having Commodore and Atari around at those times, and were you particularly paying attention to them?
Well, not so much, frankly, because Atari was really pretty much gone by then in the United States. And Commodore wasn't much of a factor here, even though it used, as I recall, I think the same basic chipset that was in a Mega Drive. So Atari we didn't really worry about. And then, of course, Atari morphed into Tengen here in the U.S., and they became a partner and a very important third-party publisher for us on the Genesis.
Well, we did mention Commodore there, and the Amiga was quite a big platform here in Britain. I do remember at the time they brought out a CD platform, and they had quite an aggressive marketing campaign against Sega. I think they even put like a billboard outside
the
your London HQ.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of that, or did you notice any of it at the time?
I you know what, I vaguely remember it, but I don't think it was. It didn't bother us a lot. I don't believe in our quest to build the Sega business in the UK.
Now, obviously, you mentioned before that the Game Boy was a big deal in America, but you came along with, we'll all agree, I think, a superior platform with the Game Gear. Was it a direct response to the Game Boy?
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that it's such an obvious thing that boys and girls would want to have portable gaming, and as certainly they do today on tablets and iPhones and other smartphones. So, yes, I mean, I think mobile was an area that we were very interested in. The one thing that always irked me was we were never able to really solve the battery life issue with Game Boy. I think it would have been so much better had we had a much longer...
Yeah, it did kind of eat through those AA batteries, didn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it did. Never were able to solve that. But as I said, you know, you're driving a color LCD screen and used a lot of juice, unfortunately.
Well, one of the really popular Game Gear things here in the UK was the TV add-on. And
Is that right? I didn't realize that because it was never that popular in the US. I mean, I liked it. We didn't sell that many of them.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know if people had cable there or something, but quite a lot of Game Gear users would use them in the UK regularly, often in school.
I'm talking about the Mega Drive. Obviously, after the Mega Drive had been out for a couple of years, we saw the introduction of the Sega CD and the 32X. What was kind of the thinking behind those from your perspective?
Well, the Sega, two different thoughts. The Sega CD, we knew that the world eventually was going to go to CD optical disc technology in any case. And we knew we had to learn how to program for it. So it was really, it was a couple of things. First of all, we had to experiment and learn how to do this. And then there was this big promise that we all bought into, which was this idea of, you're going to be able to combine full motion picture with great 3D animation, with symphonic music, rock and roll music, with real actors. And you put all that together and it's going to end up with a better gaming experience than what we have with just doing animation. And it sounds great. Not so easy to do. At least not in those days, but it was certainly a worthwhile effort. In my opinion, it was a worthwhile effort. It was something that we, as a company, had to do and had to learn from. 32X is a bit different. The promise there was it was going to help us extend the life of the 16-bit Genesis. I wasn't completely on board on this. I thought we should have kept going with the Genesis for another year. As it was, but there we were under a lot of pressure from Japan that we had to do something to have 32-bit technology. Anyway, the effort was we were supposed to have 6 games, I think, from the U.S. and 6 from Japan at time of launch. And I think we ended up with 3. It wasn't enough. They weren't different enough. There was 1 or 2 really good ones. I think Doom was pretty good. But it wasn't highly successful, obviously.
Do you think that was also due to not having a Sonic game released with it?
Oh, sure, sure. That would have helped tremendously had we been able to do that. But clearly you can't rewrite history.
Were you disappointed with the Sega CD sales?
Not so much. No, I really wasn't. Because, I it was more of a step that we had to take in order to get to the future. And everybody was in the learning experience on it. And if we hadn't done that, I think it would have taken the company a lot longer to figure out how to program on optical disc media.
Yeah, every company was out there, weren't they? Panasonic and
everybody was trying.
Nintendo never did it, though.
Not till much later.
Now, you mentioned then, the 32X and, obviously... Sega of Japan as well. I mean, did you find that you had many fights on your hand with Sega of Japan? Was it kind of a difficult relationship a lot of the time?
Well, initially it wasn't. Initially, in the book Console Wars, they depict it pretty well, where when I went over to, after really only being in the job for 3 or 4 months, I went over to Japan and said, listen, guys, here's what we're going to do. We're going to lower the price. We're going to do a lot of development in the U.S. We're going to take on Nintendo. We're going to make fun of them. We're going to go after college and teens. We're going to do tons of sports titles. They all thought I would. Oh, and by the way, we're going to put Sonic the Hedgehog in the hardware, which, of course, limits a very profitable software sale. And when you include it in the hardware, you obviously don't make much money. So in many cases, you're losing money. So they all thought I was nuts and didn't want to do it. But Nakayama, the chairman, had turned as he was leaving the room and said, hey, when I hired you, I said you could make the decisions for the Western world. And go ahead and do what you said. And so one, we were very successful the first couple of years. The relationship was quite good. But what I didn't realize was going on back in Japan, they never, as you probably are aware, Sega Japan never was that successful in the consumer market. They never got above a 10% share, whereas we had gotten to over a 50% share by 93 in the United States. And what I didn't realize was Nakayama would walk into the Monday morning management meetings and just beat the hell out of the marketing and product development team in Japan. And, you know, if somebody's beating on you all the time and saying, why aren't you as successful as those guys in the U.S. and U.K., pretty soon you get to hate those guys in the U.S. and the U.K. And so I think that's what happened. And that we got a lot less cooperation and things stopped going as smoothly by 94. It was a struggle. You know, it was a fight for anything after that point in terms of cooperation from Japan. And I wasn't aware until literally after I left the company at what was going on in Japan. I didn't realize that this feeling of animosity had developed.
One thing that I read was when they were developing the Saturn, you were kind of looking to partner with Silicon Graphics, and that kind of fell through.
Yeah, they didn't like that either. Jim Clark, who was then chairman of Silicon Graphics, and I had gotten to know each other a little bit, and he called me up, and actually the guy working for him, Jensen Wayne, is the founder of 3DX, was working at Silicon Graphics at that time, and he had developed this chipset, which looked like it was pretty good, you know, for a video game console. And my head of R&D was a guy named Joe Miller, a very, very smart guy. And when he was looking at the specs for the Saturn, he just basically said to me, I kind of worry about this. I don't know if it's good enough. And so he and I went over and met with the Silicon Graphics guys and saw what they could do and thought it was pretty impressive and invited the Japan team, the hardware team, to come over and look at this chipset. And they did, and of course they said, oh no, it's not as good as what we have. And their excuse was that the chip was too big, there'd be too much throw off in manufacturing, and it would drive the costs up. And so we didn't do it. And so Jim called me and said, well, what do I do now? And I said, well, there's this company up in Seattle you can go talk to. And he did, and made a deal up there. So that's another example of how the relationship between the U.S. and Japan was not as good as it could have been or should have been. And in my opinion, I think we were right. I think they were wrong.
What did you think of the Saturn then when you saw it?
Well, I'm not a technical person, but I was looking for bigger differences between 16-bit and what we had in Saturn. And I was also looking for more internet connectivity and ability to do multiplayer social games. And so I was a bit disappointed in it. And by that point in time, frankly, I didn't want to have to introduce it originally in the fall. And then Nakayama said, well, you're not introducing it in the fall. You're introducing it at E3 in June. And you're going to have to limit the introduction to a few retailers because we can't make enough of them to supply all retail distribution in the U.S. Oh, and by the way, we only have 3 games done. So I was not happy about this. And at that point, I pretty much, you know, I went along with it, but I started looking at other things to do.
Because I read that one of the launch titles was going to be Sonic Extreme.
That's right. And there were others, too. I mean, I don't remember now, but there were others that fell through. And you just can't or shouldn't introduce a platform when you only have 3 games available for it.
Well, obviously, it surprised a lot of developers as well. I mean, what was kind of the feedback coming towards you from developers when you kind of announced it onto the market way before they expected?
Well, everybody was angry. The developers were angry about it because they felt they'd, you know, stabbed in the back a bit because they weren't ready, couldn't have been ready. And then on top of that, much worse of a problem for me was the retailers were really furious. I mean, the people who I had grown up in the industry with, we couldn't supply them with hardware or software. You know, this was really bad in terms of relationships and feelings towards Sega and a desire by these retailers to punish Sega and get behind Nintendo and Sony, you know, and do everything they could to frankly hurt Sega at that time. So these are things that I don't think the management team in Japan really understood well enough, didn't understand the ramifications of the actions that they were taking. But clearly it really hurt the company.
That must have been, after the success you had with the Genesis, that must have been pretty heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely was. And also, I really was personally friendly with a lot of these people. So I had strong personal relationships with senior management at a lot of these retail establishments. So personally, it was pretty devastating as well.
How soon did you know that the Saturn wasn't going to be the success that you hoped it would be?
Oh, I think right from the beginning. I don't think it took us too long to figure that out. But, you know, we kept up stiff upper lip, as you would say, and forged on. And then by the end of that year, I was pretty much, had made up my mind I was going to have to leave the company.
So when you were at Sega, I mean, in the glory days as well, what was the atmosphere like there? What was it like to work there?
Oh, it was a great place. Absolutely great place. I mean, we had so much fun. I mean, we were we celebrated our successes and we celebrated good failures. You know, we had a number of those. And so, you know, we just, it was a very collegial atmosphere, very exciting. We worked very hard. People were working late into the evening. I mean, in Redwood City, we were very close to Oracle. We used to go over and eat in their lunchroom, which was attractive to us because it was basically very low cost or free. Mm-hmm. And we had programmers and people working in product development that basically spent the night in the office. I mean, they had bunk beds in there, and we were the largest consumer of pizza and Coca-Cola, I think, on the peninsula here. It was a lot of fun. And we, you know, on Fridays we had beer parties outside and barbecues. And when somebody did a great, had a great idea, but it failed, I would give them the rubber chicken award for taking a good risk that was worthwhile doing. So we had a lot of different things we did that were fun.
Some of the games that I really liked were Aladdin and Lion King. And I think they're some of the best, like, tie-in film games. How was it developing those with Disney?
Oh, yeah. That was really fun. I mean, Aladdin, I think one of the stories that I think it was recorded in the Console Wars book, but developing that with, obviously, Disney and Jeff Katzenberg was very involved, the guy who's now running DreamWorks. And at that particular E3 or CES, I forgot which now, we were going to show the game off. It was going to be introduced, and we had, I think, Richard Branson was coming in from Virgin because he had Virgin Games in the UK, and we had Katzenberg coming in, and the team that was developing the game had it on an EEPROM, and the only EEPROM that worked properly with the latest version was in the hands of one of the female product managers, and she fell asleep after being up all night. She fell asleep like 4 in the morning and wasn't there at the show. So we had nothing to show them. So I'm walking through the show with Katzenberg, and I kept stopping at different booths along the way and say, oh, look at this. Isn't that interesting? Look what this third party is doing. Or how about that package? What do you think of that, Jeff? I was just stalling for time. And I had an earpiece in where we were communicating with each other. And finally, they said, we found her. We woke her up. We've got the EEPROM. You can take him to the Sega booth now. And he never knew any of this was going on. So then we took him there and we showed him the Aladdin game. And of course, it was really good. And he loved it.
History was made. I mean, it is a great movie tie-in. And I don't think until those games, I didn't see a movie tie-in that was as polished and actually a fun game. Because before that, you'd see a lot of movie tie-in games. But generally, they were pretty poor games because they spent all the money on the license.
Or they'd have nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
You mean like Atari's E.T.?
Yeah,
that's a prime example.
Yeah, a famous example, that one, isn't it?
A kind of lot of the games were series. So, you know, you'd have Streets of Rage and you'd get the Streets of Rage 2, 3 and just taking these known formats and expanding on them.
Making them into franchises.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. And of course, I mean, I thought we did a pretty good job with Sonic while we were there. Having looked at some of the Sonic games afterward, I think they've kind of stubbed their toes a few times, and that is a great brand and still should be a great brand in the business. And I think it is still a great brand. It's amazing how strong brands, how long they will last, as long as every now and then you have a great product. But I think they had too many that weren't so great, and hopefully the next ones that come out will be great again.
Yeah, I read Sonic was more recognizable than Mickey Mouse or Bill Clinton at the time.
Yes. Yeah, we had higher Q scores than any of the Disney characters for a while.
Did you play many of the games? Were you much of a player?
Yeah, I wasn't a very good player, you know. But I did. My favorite was Sonic 2, and I would play the sports games with my kids. And I'd play the racing games largely. I still have in my basement here, I still have a 16-bit setup.
Nice.
And I still do Virtua Fighter every now and then. And,
excellent.
But I wasn't as good a game player as a lot of the people inside Sega. I mean, Joe Miller was a fantastic game player.
But to your kids, though, you must have been like the coolest guy in the world, like, you know, running Sega.
Bringing home games every day.
Well, as I really liked it when I would go pick my daughters up at school and somebody would yell out, Sega! So that was pretty cool.
Well, you mentioned the Console Wars book. Blake Harris actually, you know, spoke to you extensively while making that book. What did you think after you read it then? Did you learn any, like, new bits from it?
I mean, I knew most of the parts about Inside Sega of America, but I had no idea of what was going on in Nintendo and how they were feeling. I mean, I had some idea. I knew they didn't like us. But he really found out lots of things that I was unaware of that they were doing there to try to thwart us. And so that was eye-opening to me. And then, of course, he's the one who found out about how the folks in Japan were feeling about our success and why it actually kind of worked against us. So a lot of that stuff I learned from the book. I didn't know it beforehand.
And now they're making it into a movie, which is pretty crazy,
isn't it? We're kind of in a strange position right now. The documentary has largely been shot, but the producer, Scott Rudin, and Seth Rogen have to agree on some editing changes and music and that kind of thing, and apparently they haven't been able to get together. And the same thing for the feature film. Seth is responsible for writing the script. He has the rights to it, and he renewed those rights through January of next year, 2017. But if he doesn't get it done by then, our feeling is that that maybe somebody else will end up writing the script. Because obviously the big book has to go down to about a 220-page feature film script. You can't do a whole 60 pages in a movie.
Is it pretty crazy for you, though, that this stuff you're doing 20 years ago is now the subject of Hollywood movies?
Yeah, it's very bizarre for me. And I'm frankly still somewhat taken aback by how much interest there is in that period of time and gaming that went on in that period of time. I mean, it just never occurred to me that there were that many people interested in it. But clearly there are.
So do you know who's going to be playing you in it?
I have no idea. I have no idea. My daughters think it should be Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
not a bad choice. So in your final days at Sega then, when did you make the decision to leave?
Well, I pretty much, during the Saturn debacle, I pretty much had made up my mind to leave then. And by the way, I was somewhat open with Nakayama about that, that I wasn't happy about that. And so I started looking around at that point in time.
Did you keep an eye on Sega much after you left, like how they were doing?
Well, a little bit. But, you know, the strange thing that happens is you get so tied up in your new business that I wasn't able to stay in touch for quite a while. And you just get so busy doing that, I really didn't have time to pay much attention to the video game industry other than watching my boys play video games. So I would say I really lost track of it till about 2005. And then when we decided to divide the assets back to, of the 36 companies, back to Mr. Ellison and Milken, I started paying attention to it again. So I had a long period of time there where I wasn't paying attention.
Were you sad when Sega got out of the hardware market?
Yeah, I was. I think they stubbed their toe. But I was sad because I thought that they had opened the door and proven that Nintendo, that you could have more than one hardware manufacturer in the marketplace, opened the door for Sony to come in and for Microsoft to come in. And so I had hoped they would stay in the hardware development business. But clearly, financially, it's a burden, and you have to be very large and very successful in order to afford new hardware R&D and the inventory carrying costs of hardware and the and the low profitability of hardware, and have to have a plan where you make all your profit on the software that you sell. So I understand their rationale for it, but I am sorry that they got out.
Did you ever think you'd see the day when Sega games were coming out Nintendo hardware, though?
Never, never. Yeah. Boy, was I shocked by that. I mean, I was really floored. And I got invited back to, I guess I got invited every year. I was one of the founders of E3, so they always invite me. And for years, I didn't go. But when I went and saw Sonic and Mario a few years ago in racing, that really shocked me. And I got to play it. I played it against the demonstrator, and fortunately, I beat him. Of course, I was Sonic, and he was Mario. So I enjoyed that. But yeah, it's shocking to me.
Well, Tom, what are you up to these days? Are you involved in Leapfrog?
I had been for many, many years. I was CEO of Leapfrog, and we just arranged for the sale of Leapfrog to VTech. I'm still involved with something called Cambium Learning Group, which is using technology to improve education for young children primarily. And I'm back in the game business. I just accepted the role as chairman of Gazillion Games, where they have the Marvel license.
Oh, wow.
And so I've just started that role. And so I've now got to pay attention to the whole video game market again and get up to speed on what Steam is doing and of course, what the large companies, the large hardware manufacturers are doing. And, of course, EA and Activision and what have you. So I'm getting back into the business again at the ripe old age of 72.
And I guess that's an entirely new model, the free-to-play online game model.
Yeah, it is. It's very different for me. And obviously you have to have lots of new stuff every week for people to spend a few pennies on in order to build a business.
Must be exciting, though, being back into it.
It is. And I've always liked the people that are involved in the video game business. I always thought that some of the best programmers in the world worked on video games. You know, they solved really hard problems. Very smart people, so I do enjoy it.
Well, considering what you did last time, then, you know, second time round, it could be just as big.
Who knows? Wouldn't that be nice?
Watch this space.
Right.
Well, Tom, there's a couple of guys that grew up playing, you know, Sega games and were massive fans of the Mega Drive. And, you know, it's just amazing to have you on the show and get your stories. And we really appreciate you coming on and sharing them with us.
And we're looking forward to looking at the movie as well.
Well, thank you. So am I. And thanks for having me on the show. And best of luck to you guys. And keep up the interest in the world of video games.